You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 15 April. We've got UK unemployment data due later this morning. Expected no change at 4.4%. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Carmen Meperwani, independent analyst, JSC, the stock, not the exchange, worth perhaps having a look at. We've got high dividend yields, increased volumes due to market volatility, perhaps something there. We're chatting with Yoni Osofsky from Alex Forbes, their Money Manager Watch survey of retirement funds. We'll get data around that. And then Crib and Ready from Credo Mobility. Used car valuations. Are we doing it right? How do we get the valuations for used vehicles, which ultimately ends up in all over the market, including the likes of We Buy Cars? This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Sasol unveils a bridging plan to avert South Africa's looming gas cliff. Plans to use methane-rich gas as a stopgap to remain supplies from mid-28 to around mid-2030. Business day, blow for gold fields as Ghana rejects Damang lease renewal. Government has instructed the miner to cease operations and vacate the area by April 18th, which is Friday. Morning markets. The US was green. S&P up 0.8%. NASDAQ up 0.6%. The US 10-year a little bit down, 4.349%. East mostly green. Sydney up 0.25%. Tokyo 0.9% higher. Hong Kong is down 0.1%, while Tencent is up 0.2%. Commodities all green. Gold futures, 3,241. Brent, 64.90. Platinum, 9.58. Palladium, 9.52. The Rand is 18.89. Bitcoin, 85,300. Top 40 opening call, it just turned to zero. The top 40 is going to open flat.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Carmen Meperwani, independent analyst. Carmen, appreciate the early morning time. As I said in the intro there, just I've been seeing much bigger value traded on the JSE. This is particularly because we've had wildly volatile days. Notwithstanding, our market is set to open unchanged this morning. That will probably change at some point. The volatility is not going to go away. The JSE on a dividend yield almost 7, a price earnings low single digits. Is there value here for a stock which I think a lot of people think is perhaps, I don't know, sort of ex-growth, but some opportunity and volatility?
Yeah, I think the key, Simon, of what you're saying is definitely the ex-growth. Mm. And the concern there would definitely lie around in the current environment. If we are to go into a recession, number one, you know, do you want to be an ex-growth company? Is that where you're going to see a recovery? There may be better opportunities. I know we've spoken about this before, is, you know, you obviously can't look at one stock in isolation because there may be better opportunities than investing in JSE Limited itself. In terms of the volatility, we did speak about this last week. It has come down slightly, but still remains elevated at about that 32. If you remember, the marker I gave was at about 70 for volatility. So I'm not that enticed by a divvy yield of 7%. It's good, but it's not amazing. I'm sure at the levels, you know, where shares are pulling back now, you'd see dividend yields that are going to be more elevated than that. So it's a difficult one. I always say that, I know. But you know, you can't look at things in isolation. You see markets plummeting one day, and by the end of the day, it's recovered again. Yeah. So I'd be weary.
I take your point on that. I mean, I know that they would also say that they're listing a lot of sort of listed funds in the space, but yeah, a listed fund's never going to do the billions of rands of volume that a NASPAS or an MTN or something does. But when you say you're not going to look at it in isolation, you'd look at others out there. Would you sort of do in this environment, a top-down looking at sectors or individual stocks from bottom-up?
I use a combination of both. So I'd first start with top-down. Mm-hmm. You know, look out to see which sectors in a recession were the best performing coming out of a recession, because we're not looking at a short-term time horizon.
Yeah.
And then once you can see which sectors you think are likely to be the outperformers, look for the superstars within those. Those ones, like you said, that have growth. Those that are at the stage where, you know, they've got management that are able to pull them out of recession if it comes to that. But more importantly, an offering that is going to see or be boosted by an economy that's coming out of a recession. Because I think we are pretty close to that. And if we're not planning and preparing for that, then, that, you know, that would be a big error.
Yeah, no, I take your point. Defensive might be the place to be, but it might not be the JSC. Does anything at a high level sort of jump out? I mean, are there sort of classic sectors which one would think, that's a place to maybe go do some digging?
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at the miners, and I know most people don't like them, but they are the big ones on the JSC, and we've seen them pull back quite a bit. So it's to dissect that and determine, you know, are those levels that we saw plummeting last week, are they reasonable for those miners? Mm-hmm. They are likely to recover. We're going to see the biggest fallout there because of the tariffs and the concern of what else could happen to mining companies, because we don't know what Trump is going to do next. But other than that, I'll definitely look at what the consumer is reliant on. Sort of, you know, basic needs. Those are definitely the keys, healthcare, etc. That's sort of where I'd start looking.
Yeah, I take your point. And the miners, Goldman Sachs yesterday saying gold could plausibly, stress the plausibly, and the could trade at $4,500 by the end of the year. We'll leave it there. Kamal Meporani, independent analyst, always appreciate the early morning time. That's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. It's about the JSC. Kamal makes a great point. Yeah, dividend yield is attractive, but it is X growth, and that is perhaps the worry. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Yonina Slarsky, Head Investment Consulting at Alex Forbes. Yonina, appreciate the time. Your December 2024 edition of the Manager Watch Survey of Retirement Funds Investment Managers has just come out. I want to dig into some details. I suppose first question, who is our largest asset manager in the survey? If I remember correctly, we chatted a year ago and it was 91. Are they still top of the boat?
Yes, they are. In fact, it's one of the most exciting moments when we launch. All the asset managers want to know if they've maintained or lost positions. So yes, still 91, followed by StanLib.
Okay, StanLib next. One of the notable shifts, reading through the report, is the continued rise of multi-managers. I mean, it's still only about a third of assets under management. It's doubled in the last 5 or so years, and that's a significant move.
It is, and very much driven by what's happening in the broader retirement fund market. A lot of standalone funds have been looking at moving into umbrella funds. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, often they will no longer want to have an asset consultant, want to make their own allocations, et cetera, although umbrella funds generally allow them to. So it's a huge trend. And we personally, as multi-managers, have received large clients moving into umbrella fund and investing into our multi-managed solutions. Essentially, it's reducing complexity, reducing governance budget, which is a huge trend across the retirement fund industry.
Yeah. And that was one of the points. I mean, we talk costs a lot on this show, and I'm quickly trying to pull up the numbers here. You know, folks would tell me, it's expensive. There's fees, and there are fees. You have to pay for what we get, unfortunately. But we do see that the cost world has been moving cheaper and is, frankly, very, very competitive. There it is, 0.68%, 0.83%, the first for domestic equity, the second global. Costs have really come down to, we're talking fractions of a percent, literally.
Agreed. And obviously, overall, funds have started to look at allocations to passive. In fact, particularly in the offshore space, where active management for South African investors hasn't always been rewarded. But yes, a lot of pressure, competition, new managers coming on the block, willing to discount initially, etc. And obviously, a lot of moves, in some instances, just away from performance fees, but certainly within performance fees to have better alignment, high watermarks, caps. So yes, it's a significant trend internationally, and definitely we're following in South Africa.
Broad BEE ratings also reaching new highs, which is another good trend. A lot of folks will have a lot to say about it, but it's good for the industry and good for the country.
It's amazing, actually, just how dedicated managers have been to actually getting this right. I mean, it's massive in terms of the percentage that have achieved level one. And that takes a lot because obviously it's requirements at the board level, senior management, procurement, etc. So they've pulled every single lever. I mean, it's almost a given now that most managers are level one, and you're looking for even majority black owned as a new differentiator, which is a very significant trend, as you'll also see in the survey.
The other big one is ESG, environmental, social and governance. I mean, certainly President Trump is anti this. He's said coal is the future. He's pulled out of the Paris climate. But in our fund managers, ESG is rising and becoming more important and more significant.
Agreed. I mean, obviously, we can't necessarily get a lot from our survey. We only put in CRISA and PRI signatory figures, but that has been increasing dramatically. And I mean, we expect all managers to subscribe to CRISA. There is expense involved in PRI, but that's also been increasing nicely, and especially amongst the larger managers. And in terms of overall responsible investing, we still think asset managers think it is right to invest responsibly. So even if the markets turned a bit against it, we still expect managers to be responsible, and we do think it's going to give better investment returns in the long term.
Yeah, and that's the key point. And data does support that, that over the long term, responsible investing makes for better investing. The last one of the 47 managers in the global BIV category, 39, more than 30% of the portfolios in December, 10% around above 40%. Globalization very much remains on the rise in the investment world.
Well, dramatic, actually, if you look at the change in best investment view for global mandates. When the regulation up to 45% was first passed, in fact, not many managers moved because at that stage, South Africa was quite attractive. Now, obviously, given the volatility and current environment, sticks out rather. And huge percentage now have gone over 30, massively also over 40, and some maintaining at 45. And what we've actually seen is a lot of switch out of local equity into international equity. And obviously, a lot of our local is rand hedged, so it's not necessarily more dollar exposure. It's better quality exposure. Because now if a manager says, I want to be in this sector, I'm not going to look the best counter in the world, might be JSE, but often they're actually saying, I'm finding a better counter internationally. So quality of portfolios for our local clients significantly enhanced. But obviously your ability to make that decision correctly, both how much offshore and where you invest it, will mean dispersion of returns between managers much, much more significant than has been in the past.
Yeah, I take the point in that. It's about that range of quality. You want the best, I don't know, pizza company in the world. You want to be able to find it and buy it. We'll leave it there. That's Nina Slowski, Head Investment Consultant at Alex Forbes. Appreciate the time.
Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Quibin Reddy, founder and CEO of Credo Mobility. Quibin, appreciate the early morning time. In a growing second-hand vehicle market, we're certainly seeing it growing faster than in the new vehicle market. A key point is vehicle valuations. First question for you, how are vehicles currently valued in South Africa in the second-hand space?
And thanks for having me. So there's a single supplier of a guide into the industry, and that guide gives you an indication of a unique make, model, and variant of a vehicle linked to certain year models. So the introduction year of when that vehicle would have come out, and a discontinuation year, and between those years, a trade and retail value is produced linked to that derivative. And the methodology of creating or producing that trade and retail value is really a historical view on that vehicle. So sales activity is recorded on that particular derivative from a previous period in order to almost determine or predict what the current month or, you know, up to maybe 2 months or 3 months into the future that vehicle would depreciate at.
I get your point, but and you mentioned that, you know, sort of 2-3 months into the future. In other words, quite short term. How I mean, I'm thinking, you know, we're sitting here in the world of obviously of internet, of artificial intelligence. How sort of smart is this process, or is it still a fairly not manual, but perhaps a little outdated in terms of some of the technology?
Absolutely. And I think that's where, to be quite honest, that's where the big gap comes in. So, you know, traditionally the data would be collected from dealerships physically. So a dealership would record, this is their sales data. They would send it through manually into the central database, etc. Over time, obviously, with the electronic systems, that became more electronic. But the fact is, if you're using lagging sales data, one, the market has changed rapidly. So in terms of volume of sales, etc., that's reduced significantly over the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years. Pre-global financial crisis was sort of the height of the motor industry in South Africa. So you've got a factor of volume. And then secondly, quality plays a big role, the quality of the data itself that's feeding into the system. And you're right. Currently, in a real-term sense, in terms of how dealers will actually access different data points or different data sets, et cetera, to value and look at what a vehicle is worth in terms of what they should pay or what they should sell for. There's a number of different online sources. So a dealer might use a marketplace to gauge what's the current number of vehicles of that derivative available in the market. You know, if he has to buy one or price one that a dealer's got 10 in stock already or in his region, those are vehicles of high supply. You know, his pricing is going to adjust significantly based on that. And the big gap is that the traditional valuation models or systems haven't necessarily factored in all of those dynamics to price in a real-time situation.
And we're talking here, my initial question and thought stream was around sort of, you know, my purchasing a secondhand vehicle, or maybe I'm doing a trade-in. But there's a bigger implication here as well, which is in terms of insurance, which obviously needs a reliable price point and as it changes, because, you know, otherwise you can find yourself either under or over-insured for a particular vehicle.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the bigger, broader conversation across the ecosystem. So when you look at insurance, banking, the dealership environment and the consumer, I think the other gap that's been created or that hasn't been sort of satisfied is that over time, those industries are working in totally different ways, and they are using different data points to determine the different requirements. So the dealer, as an example, is buying and selling on the day. It's almost likened to a stock exchange kind of environment, and the dealer is probably the most sensitive, because they have, in the short term, the most to lose. If you overpay or underpay, you know, it affects margin, you can't move the car quick enough, there's high repercussions there. And then to your point, the insurance impact, and we saw this during COVID as an example. So during COVID, there were supply issues on new vehicles with the semiconductor issues, et cetera. That spiked used vehicle values, not across the board, but there were certain models and variants that increased by up to 30% to 40%.
Wow!
Now, many consumers in that situation would have found themselves in a difficult situation, because they would have purchased pre-COVID, and the valuation at the time, you know, that's what the used vehicle value is that would have been used by the insurer and the banking system, and that's fundamentally different at that point in time from a replacement value. So if you were a consumer and your car was written off during COVID, the chances of you being underinsured were extremely high, just purely because of that dynamics. The second thing, during COVID we picked up as well, is that even in the banking system, so a dealer would be purchasing a used vehicle for 30 to 40% over what the traditional retail value would be showing, you know, as per a book or a guide. And the banks would question, you know, why is the financing of that vehicle going to be 30 to 40% higher? And that created contention as well. And inevitably, you know, all that happened during COVID is the banks relaxed some of their models or allowed, you know, for this overage. But it does create a big issue when real-time economics and real-time data points are not being utilized.
You mentioned up front as well around a single dominant player. I mean, is this a space where there are new players coming, where new systems are being used, or is it kind of stuck in where it is? I mean, are we seeing some innovation and changes coming through to sort of snip away at the dominant player?
Yeah, look, I think absolutely. The challenge is the barriers are quite high. So you've got a dominant player that's been around for over 60 years. The print book in itself is not available anymore. So that was discontinued a few years ago. But, you know, the reality is that the model or the output hasn't fundamentally changed. So all you did was change the channel by going from, you know, print to digital. So you're still getting effectively the same output. So the barriers are high. However, to your point, there's a number of innovations in that space. One of the big challenges around adoption is getting a customer. So whether you consider a customer, a dealer, a bank or an insurer, et cetera, is to adopt a complementary service or an alternate service. And I think, you know, the thinking, Simon, is not so much that you have to replace. So there's a space for a historical valuation and a consistent, predictable, you know, value on a vehicle. If you look at banks and insurers, they're more concerned about the future value of that car because they're operating on the risk in the future versus a dealer is current time. So I think, you know, there's definitely innovation in that space. It's become easier also to access data points, access data at quality. If you look at the vehicles just advertised, you know, on different platforms, there is consistency and standardization that's occurred over the years in terms of that data that's sitting out there. So there's definitely innovation, but the gaps and the barriers, or rather the barriers more, are still quite high to get adoption across the ecosystem.
Yeah, but I also like to point out, it doesn't need to be an either or, it can be a blend of. We'll leave it there. It's Kuben Reddy, founder and CEO, Credo Mobility. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. Chatting with Nick Kunze yesterday about the 10-year yield at that point, just below 4.5. We asked which way is it likely to move. Over half of you said higher for longer. Quarter said back below 4%. Rest said staying where it is. It has crept out a little bit, but typically the 10-year moves in little bits. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. U.S. tariffs. What is the China response?
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.